Good morning. What an honor to be with you this morning. What a beautiful group of people we have, and just a wonderful group of children. I have just been sitting here and enjoying just all the energy and all the children. So, trauma is something that I care deeply about, and so it's my hope that as we sit together here this morning, that we can be better equipped to work with our students or our children that have been entrusted to us. As I was getting ready for this session, I had entitled it Caring for Children with Trauma at School, and that's probably kind of a giveaway. Yes, I am a teacher. But we could easily have titled it Caring for Children with Trauma, because I think the lines are not so much between parents and teachers. Yes, there are definitely differences, but I think that as we think about our children who come from hard places, our children who come out of traumatic circumstances, it's about learning how we can serve them better. So, the more I learn about trauma, the more I see that it has some very particular ways of presenting itself. Now, obviously, I see it in the classroom. You're going to see it in your homes. And so I really want us to be able to do well with our children. I'm going to give you just a brief introduction as to who I am. And hopefully that'll give you a little bit of an idea of my story, where I'm coming from as I talk about some of these things. So I am not an adopted child. I am a biological child. I was born into a home with two parents, and parents who wanted this baby, wanted this pregnancy. However, when I was 4.5 years old, my dad died very unexpectedly. So I was raised in a single parent home, and my dad was my safe person. He was one of the most kind, gentle people that I know. And so when he died, it was like I lost my safe person. And his passing was definitely one of the big T traumas in my life. I'm going to explain that term in just a little bit. I come out of a really hard, dark past. I've been able to track like trauma and abuse. I've been able to track it back through my family for at least 3 generations, maybe 4. And so that's been difficult to realize. But like when we're talking about abuse, it's just almost on every level what I experienced. There was a lot of verbal abuse in my family, some physical abuse, there was some spiritual abuse, psychological abuse, there was some abuse that had sexual overtones, and yeah, it's a hard, dark past. And I was an adult before I really realized the impact that this had on my body and my nervous system. Trauma has a way of imprinting on one's nervous system. Well, I didn't want to repeat these negative cycles. As I said, this has come down to me through generations. I had seen a lot of wrong, some of it done in the name of Christianity, but I wanted to be an adult who is functioning well and who is a safe person for my students. And so I began to see a therapist. I started having flashbacks in 2017, and that really pushed me to begin therapy. So I wanted to be healthy and thriving, not just surviving. So what I'm sharing with you today are things that I've learned on my journey to healing, and I hope that it can be a blessing to you as well. I have a handout that I sent to the secretary, and I'm curious, are there any handouts around? If you want to maybe just go check that, I think she has them printed. I'm a teacher after all, and so no, there's not going to be a quiz, But I do want you to have a handout to be able to just follow along with me. While they're checking on the handouts, I want us to look at this second slide. Whoops, back up. So I have a reason for this slide here, and you're going to see it in your handout, you'll see it completely in your handout. So my reason for this slide is one of the things that I noticed as I was growing up was there were a lot of myths around children who were adopted, okay? A myth being something that's not true. And some of the statements that I heard growing up sometimes, you have children who've experienced adoption, and sometimes their less than ideal behavior was just excused with, well, they're adopted. I don't know if any of you have felt that that stigma with around your children. And that makes me completely so angry because it is really, really unfair. So I just wanted to list some myths here or some untruths and then some truths. So one of the myths would be only children who have experienced adoption have trauma. That is obviously not true. You heard my story. There's a lot of trauma in my life, even though I'm a bio child. The other myth that I felt sometimes growing up is that if you are an adopted child, that was somehow a shameful experience. Also not true. And then the third one, adopted children have needs that we do not understand. Now, the truth of the matter is we all have needs. So I want you just to look at the truths here that I have listed on the right. And sometimes it is helpful for me to look at the myth, look at what is not true, and then replace that with the truth. So you could look on the right side here. Only children who have experienced adoption have trauma. And the truth is all children, whether bio or adoptive, can experience trauma. You look at the myth about the shameful experience. The truth is being adopted can be a beautiful, loving, gracious thing and can show us the heart of God. And after all, we are all adopted into the family of God. And I think that's been a piece sometimes that we've missed. And then another truth, all people have needs. All of us need good attachment, love, and knowing that we belong. So I just wanted to kind of preface my topic there with saying those things. Okay, what is trauma? We've heard a lot about trauma already. Paul and Rebecca did such a good job last night in just helping us think through that. But I want to look at trauma here, and I'm going to define it as little t trauma versus big T trauma. How many of you have heard this idea? Yeah, okay, so it is out there, that's good. So I'm gonna just compare the two a little bit. And as they're checking into handouts there, maybe you can fill some things in then later. Okay, so let's talk about what is a little t trauma. Okay, first of all, a little t trauma exceeds our capacity to cope. It causes disruption. All right. It is a distressing event, although it's not necessarily life-threatening. Okay, so your child might not know where you are in the moment, and they can't find you. That feels overwhelming. That feels distressing. But that's not a life-threatening situation. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So that's an example of a little t trauma. A financial concern, or like when finances are tight, that could also be considered a little t trauma. Even something like moving or relocating. I don't know if you've ever moved and you're like, wow, we moved into a bigger house. This space fits us, and our children are just disrupted. Okay? Even something good like a move can be a little t trauma. Relationship conflicts. If you are, not on the same page with with a friend, that can feel really distressing. Little T traumas tend to make the individual feel helpless, all right? So again, like we said, not life-threatening, but it will you'll tend to feel helpless. Let's shift now and compare little T to what we call big T trauma. So a big T trauma can be an extraordinary or significant event. It can be life-threatening. For example, if you were in an accident and you were fighting for life, you're trying to survive, that could be considered a big T trauma. Another example of that would be like a natural disaster or an earthquake, a car accident, constant neglect and abuse, death. I had mentioned my dad's death at the beginning here. That for me was a big T trauma. And with big T traumas, individuals tend to feel powerless and out of control. So as you look at the two lists here, and you'll see that on your handout when they come, as you look at your two lists, you have, you can kind of compare them, okay? Now, I want to say here that you might look at this and be like, okay, well, the big T traumas are the big things. I haven't had, you know, anything that significant in my life, so maybe this doesn't matter. No, all of our trauma is valid. There are little T traumas that can build and build and build, and they can culminate into big T traumas. So I think that helps me understand trauma just a little bit more. Do we have an update on the handouts?
They're working on right now.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. Oh, yes. I just wanted to mention that. I want to note the little T trauma, big T trauma, that comes, my source for that was from Psychology Today. Okay. This is probably one of my favorite slides here in this presentation. And no, this is not a science lesson on the brain, but did I mention that I'm a teacher? Yeah, okay. So what I want to do as we think about caring for our children with trauma, whether that's in school, whether that's at home, I want to take a look at the brain and try to help you understand a little bit more what's actually happening in the brain of your student or your child when they face trauma. So the human brain is a very complex organ, and this is a pretty simplified picture. But, and some of the ways that I'm talking about the brain are probably a little bit oversimplified. I'm just stating that because brains, human brains are very complex. But I have just learned so much about trauma and the brain, and I find that it's been so helpful for me to understand. So let's take a look here. Thank you so much. If you want to go ahead, I think this image of the brain is on the second page of your handout there. Am I right? Second page? Yeah. Okay. So let me remind you just a little bit about the structure of our brain, and then we'll dive more into what this has to do with trauma. So our brain has two hemispheres. There's the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. We also have our brain stem. The brain stem is responsible for your more, like the more primitive functions. Okay, so when your infant is born, they're born with a fully functioning brain stem. And how do you know that? Well, what do they do when they're hungry? They cry, all right? They let you know something's wrong. So you need to have a fully functioning brainstem in order to survive. So your brainstem will take care of things like breathing, heartbeat, blood pressure. So just very basic survival, things that you need for survival. And then we have a couple other things that I'm going to touch on. The cortices, or maybe you may have heard it as cortex. Probably you might be familiar with the prefrontal cortex, okay? That's the part that's responsible for reasoning. If you've ever tried arguing with your three-year-old, you know it's a disaster, right? My sister was mentioning to me how her husband was like, what is going on here? And she said, honey, you're trying to argue with the three-year-old, okay? Their prefrontal cortex, the way they reason, is not developed. In fact, your prefrontal cortex does not fully develop until you're an adult. Some say 25 years old. I like to say, well, okay, it's not fully developed until adulthood, but it's responsible for reasoning. So it helps me to understand my students, like especially if I'm working with my middle school students and some of the ways that they reason. If I'm not curious, I can be like, where did you come up with that answer? Okay, but then remembering that there's still, this prefrontal cortex is still developing. And then we have the hippocampus and the amygdala. So the amygdala, the last one there on your list there, this is really what I want to focus in on today. The amygdala is the part of the brain that keeps you safe. It's constantly scanning for danger. So you might be sitting here right now. I don't know. Hopefully all of you feel safe in this environment. But you know, if you have children coming into your home, you know that sometimes they haven't always felt safe. Okay, so I have students coming in to my classroom, and one of the first things that I really work on is establishing felt safety. I want them to know that they're safe with Ms. Coons, because learning is not going to happen if the child does not feel safe. So your amygdala keeps you safe. It's constantly scanning for danger. Let's think of an example, a practical example of how your amygdala works. Amygdala. I know that's a big word. Everyone say amygdala. Amygdala. Yeah, see, it's not a difficult word to say. So I want you to picture with me that you are driving down the road and you come to a traffic light. The light turns green, and you're getting ready to go through. As you're going through that intersection, just at the last minute, you see this F-350 come barreling toward you and just slams right into your vehicle. Okay, your amygdala is going to alert you that, like, this is dangerous. Something happened, right? Thankfully, let's say you were okay, your car was damaged, but you were okay. Well, what do you think is going to happen the next time that you approach that same intersection? Anyone want to give me a guess?
Your hippocampus will kick in, you'll remember
it. Right, you'll remember it, yes. What do you think might happen to your heart rate? Yeah, your heart rate's going to go up. And your blood pressure is going to go up. Now, I could say to you, but why is that going to happen? You're completely safe. You could look around and be like, there are no F-350s coming at me. I am completely safe. The thing is, your amygdala has stored that information. She was responsible. I say she because take a look at amygdala. Do you see what the first three letters are there? Amy. So sometimes I like to call her Amy just to help me out. She's responsible for keeping you safe. So she's going to remind you, hey, this intersection might be dangerous. That truck was red. Look around for F-350s, okay? Okay, so let's take that illustration away. Let's say that you're driving down the road. You're nowhere close to the intersection where that accident happened, but you're driving down the road, and suddenly coming towards you, you see a red F-350. What do you think is going to happen? Same thing, right? Why? You're not anywhere close to that intersection. Why is the same thing going to happen? Why are you going to be having these physiological responses?
Is it because your brain thinks you're
Right. Your amygdala, or Amy, is working very well. She's telling you, hey, this is a red F-350. This could be dangerous. All right? So no amount of logic will bring your heart rate back down. Now, obviously, is there hope for this? Yes. And if this was a really traumatic experience for you, you may, go to therapy and learn how to calm your amygdala. How can you speak truth so that you don't spend the rest of your life being afraid of red F-350s? Does that make sense? Am I connecting that? Good. Okay. The same thing happens with our kids. Yes, sir?
Suppose the red F-350 was a parent.
I'm sorry?
Suppose the red F-350 was a
parent. Yes, absolutely. I love that question. And I think for so many of our children, that happens. You know, he's saying, what if that experience, what if that traumatic experience came from a parent? Am I following you there? Yeah. Exactly. And that's where we're going here in just a bit. Thank you for that question. The same thing happens with our children. Perhaps they have come to you from very abusive home situations. The person who was supposed to be their caregiver beat them up or beat up their siblings. Maybe they were denied food. Maybe they were denied medical care. And if you're not prepared for what they have gone through, some of their responses that trigger them can really catch you off guard. So to illustrate this, I'm going to read a small story from The Connected Child. I'm curious, are any of you familiar with Dr. Karen Purvis? Okay, yes, good. I was hoping that she'd be fairly well recognized here. She has done a lot of work with children from hard places. But I want to read just a part of her book here that illustrates this so well. If you have the book, I'm in chapter 4. Referencing how we can disarm the fear response with felt safety. 6-year-old Janie didn't have much of an appetite during the day at school, but later, when her attention deficit hyperactive disorder, or ADHD, drugs wore off, she would become ravenous. One evening she asked, "Mommy, I'm hungry. Can I have a snack bar?" Busy in the kitchen, preparing a large meal for her family, her mother replied, "No, dear, in 10 minutes we're going to eat the chicken and vegetables I'm fixing for supper." Janie exploded into tears and began shrieking, "I hate you, I hate you. You're so mean, you're a mean mother. You never let me have anything." The little girl ran into her bedroom, slammed the door, and began to sob loudly. Now you might be like, what's up with that? Is she just being willfully disobedient? Horrified, Janie's bewildered and disappointed mom couldn't imagine what had triggered that outburst. Disturbing behaviors like tantrums, hiding, hyperactivity, or aggressiveness are often triggered by a child's deep primal fear. Youngsters like Janie can be physically safe in their new adoptive home, but past traumas encoded within their brains are easily reactivated. Deep fear caused Janie to explode into tears when she was denied the snack bar. To a little girl who had spent a painfully hungry year in an orphanage, the promise of dinner in 10 minutes was no real comfort. She remembered going to bed hungry every night after orphanage workers ignored her pleas for food. Do you see the big T trauma happening there? Even though Janie's mom understood that good food was coming shortly and her daughter was in no danger of starving, the traumatized primitive part of Janie's brain just couldn't grasp that. Starvation is encoded in her deepest memory. When refused a snack bar, she panicked because she feared she would die of starvation. So, how can we provide Janie with safety? Well, I think this is a time to be curious. I think Paul and Rebecca mentioned curiosity yesterday. And I find curiosity helps me so much. Rather than judging the situation, asking, what could cause that? How might Janie's mother have responded in a way that provided felt safety without spoiling her daughter's appetite for a home-cooked meal? Here's one example. When Janie said, "Mom, I'm hungry. Can I have a snack bar?" Mom could have said, "Yes, dear, you may have a snack bar and you may eat it right after supper." Mom puts the snack bar into her daughter's hands. "Do you want to put it beside your plate on the dinner table or keep it in your pocket until dinner is over?" Now notice, the boundary still didn't change. She's still not allowed to eat until after supper, but now she has something visual that she can look at and see. Now Janie can touch the food and know it is hers to keep. Deciding whether to put the snack bar on the table or to keep it with her makes Janie feel more in control of the situation, and it lets her practice self-control. Small choices like this are comforting to a traumatized child, and they build trust. Whoops, not sure where that came from. Okay, let's look now at some typical coping mechanisms for dealing with trauma. Probably all of you have heard of the fight, flight, freeze. Yeah, okay. And if you have, you know, a number of children, you may actually notice perhaps one child tends to go to fight while the other child goes to flight and so on. Fight, flight, freeze. We're familiar with that. I feel like we're less familiar with fawn, the one here on the right. Those are the people pleasers. They're very codependent. And people who fawn know how to twist themselves, like I sometimes like to say, they can twist themselves into a pretzel, into whatever shape they need to please their caregivers, okay? So fawning is really psychologically complex, I think. So be aware of your children who feel like they need to take care of you. I personally have lots and lots of experience with fawning. And as an adult, I still have to work really hard because even though that was my coping mechanism, that is literally what helped me survive my trauma, as an adult, it doesn't serve me. It does not help me to be healthy. And that's one of the reasons that I go to therapy, because I want to be a healthy adult and then in turn serve my children well. I will let you read the descriptions there on your own. So, trauma is big, it's heavy. We have children who come from hard places. We have children who come into our classrooms. Is there hope? Is there hope?
Yes.
Yes. There is so much hope for all of our little people. And so, in the second part here of my talk, I want to look here at what we can do as caregivers, as parents and teachers. How can we help our students and our children heal from trauma? So, humans need lots of things, obviously, to heal from trauma, but I'm going to look at three in particular. So, first of all, let's talk about felt safety. You recognize that term from Karen Purvis's book, Felt Safety. Felt safety is different from just being safe, okay? So right now, as you're sitting here, are you safe? Yeah. There's no gunmen in the room. There's no predators looking outside, lurking outside, you know, looking in, seeing if they can capture you. You're safe here, okay? But if you would have had a traumatic experience happening in this room, you may not feel safe, even if you know that you are safe. So, one of the ways that I think about felt safety in my classroom, as I begin a new year with my students, this is one of the things that I work on very hard at the beginning, because I want my students to know when they come into my classroom, Ms. Coons is a safe person. She's not going to yell at me. She's not going to hit me. She's going to help me learn. So we talk. I try to establish a classroom environment where they know that it's okay to make mistakes. We don't laugh at other people when they make mistakes. And building that classroom culture of helping them to feel safe. Now, I know that my students are safe. So let's say if one of my six-year-olds, she might not have words for it, but if she is really wondering, am I safe here, I can stand here and tell her. I can be like, Susie, you're safe here at school. The outside doors are locked. The secretary doesn't let anyone in. People have to ring the bell for them to come into school, okay? But that's intellectual safety. That's different from felt safety. And so I can lecture her on how she is safe, but I'm going to have to build those experiences so that she knows that she's safe with me. Is that making sense? Yeah. Okay. And I found in my own story, just working through trauma, I did not realize initially as I was going to therapy how important it is for me to feel safe. All right, so felt safety. Humans also need caregivers who have a mindset of curiosity. I'm not sure how much curiosity is going to come up this weekend, but it is such a good word, and I want to talk about it a little bit more. So in my work with students in the past few years, I have been working with some middle school students. So I've been in education for almost 2 decades at this point. And the last few years I was working in learning support more as a tutor. And one week I noticed one of my eighth graders was coming into my classroom. And that week, he was just really cynical. And he would just make offhand comments. His comments were like, well, do you teachers have a handbook? Well, does your handbook say that teachers shouldn't yell at students? And those were his comments. Where is your handbook? You know, I think you should look to see what it says. Now, I could have told him, Johnny, actually, if I'm talking about my students here, I have obviously changed names just to protect their identity, and I don't think any of my students are in here. Okay, if they are, no worries. My stories are not about you. So relax a little bit there. I have almost 2 decades to pull from, so yeah, my stories are not about you. So, but back to Johnny. I could have said, Johnny, you need to talk respectfully to me. That is not a way to talk to Ms. Coons. Well, you think that's going to help my eighth grader? I am going to just shut him right down. So the comments continued for a bit, and one day I asked him, I said, Johnny, was there something that happened? Do you want to tell me what happened? Because I just sensed that there was probably an incident going on. And he paused a little bit, and I should also back up to say, at this point, I had worked with him for almost 2 years. We had established a good relationship. And I felt like he trusted me, and he said, well, I guess it's safe to say this. And I think I just assured him, like, you may say anything here that you need to. I am here for you, and I want to hear what you have to say. And he went on and told me about an incident that had happened in one of their art classes, and he talked about the way that one of the teachers had spoken to him. Now, that was a big deal for him. Maybe, you know, the event by itself may not have been a big deal, but I was very suspicious that he was experiencing verbal abuse from his dad at home. And so he has this big T trauma that he's dealing with. And then, excuse me, when one of the teachers talks to him, and to him it feels like yelling, it's just going to feel like a trigger. So in that case, I thought it was my responsibility to exercise a mindset of curiosity of what's actually going on here. How can I care for you with what happened? Curiosity became the gateway for him to talk about how he felt violated. So, humans need felt safety, they need a mindset of curiosity, and they need a calm, safe presence in their caregivers. Many, many, many times in my life, I have seen when children become chaotic, it's like they flip their lid. I'm going to explain that in just a minute. And then their caregivers join the chaos by yelling or maybe punishing and getting angry, and the situation just escalates, and it becomes crazy. Okay, so I want you to take your hand right now just to demonstrate this. Okay, take your dominant hand and put your thumb underneath with your fingers over top of it like this, okay? We're going to pretend that this is your brain and then pull it toward yourself like this. So your dominant hand is pulled towards you. Okay, so I want you to imagine here that your arm here is your brain stem. Okay, this is more primitive functioning here, all right? This image is a picture of when your child is calm and, let's say, they're feeling safe, they're feeling emotionally regulated. When you have children, I would say especially those who go into, like, fight mode, it literally is like their lid flips. You see what happens there? So the lid flips and the emotions just go, and it's an explosion. Okay. Well, you can choose to join the chaos. You can be the adult who has a lid who also flips, and then your emotions explode, and then you've got this volcanic eruption. Okay. So when your child flips their lid, one of the things that they need is just a really calm, safe, steady caregiver. This is called, like, when the child flips their lid, like their brain is offline. They're not reasoning. And they need an adult who is calm and steady, who can help them regulate. So seeing the adult being emotionally regulated, that process is called co-regulation. Everyone say co-regulation. Yes. You are the adult, you can help them emotionally regulate again. And then I wanted to say as well, extensive trauma will likely need help from a professional therapist. And just the conversations that I've been having with some of you this weekend, where you're putting in the resources, you're putting in the time to take your children to therapy, thank you. That is one of the best gifts that you can give them. Okay. So, how can we help our children cope? Does anyone resonate with this image? This happens in the classroom too, not just at home. But let's look at a couple ways that we can help them cope. And let me just go on to the next one here. This is where we're going to see a bit of difference between parents and teachers, okay? So never underestimate the power of holding and rocking your child. Did you know that rocking is very calming to the nervous system? It activates the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, I know those sound like a lot of big words, but basically, it's where your body goes into like rest and digest. Rocking is very soothing to the nervous system. Now, obviously, as a teacher, I'm not going to be rocking your child, okay? That would be crossing professional boundaries for me. But you as the parent, you as the mom, you as the dad, your children need touch. They need lots of touch. They need to be held. Several years ago, I was at one of my friend's houses, and we were getting ready to finish up the day, and we're going to have a little devotional and prayer. And her oldest son came and sat in her lap during devotions, and he was in middle school at the time. And later, I commented to her about, like, that's so neat. Your son came and sat on your lap. And she's like, oh, yeah, he likes to do that. I was so incredibly blessed to see that. So it's not just your, you know, 4 and 5-year-olds that need to be held and just know beyond a shadow of a doubt that their parents love them. One of the things that I will do at school to help just bring down, if the lid is flipped, or to help students regulate is, okay, so take your hand here. Did you know there's a lot of nerve endings in your hand? So sometimes if I have a student who is doing everything they know they should not do, okay? I've been amazed sometimes just with saying, here, can I give you a hand massage? And I'll just work at, you know, rubbing her hand, kind of bringing down that emotional regulation. I've been amazed at that. The other way that I deal with it at school, let's say I have a student who we're trying to read, and again, they're doing everything they know they shouldn't. I have found it very helpful to pause, sit on the floor. This year I had a little corner with pillows that were set up. Sometimes we would sit on the floor and just read a book for a bit. And especially if it's a child who hasn't gotten a lot of physical touch, I would be amazed sometimes at how that child would like sit so tightly against me, almost as if she wanted to borrow my nervous system, okay? Not that my nervous system is the most healthy, but it did seem that physical contact would help to bring her back down, and she could regulate. All right. We also need to care for our children's physical and emotional needs. And I'm speaking to the choir here. You all know that children need much, much more than just clothing and food. That would be a very easy life, right? If we just gave them clothing and food and we'd know they're good. They have emotional needs. They want to hear from you. They want to be touched and loved. The other ways we can help them cope are by using children's books as resources. So I have a couple resources here that I just want to show you, and you can look these up later. These books are by Dawn Hubner, and these are very children-specific. So this one is What to Do When Your Brain Gets Stuck. This is a child's guide to overcoming OCD. And as you look at the pages, it's just very, I say it's very kid-friendly. Even I, as an adult, like to look through it because sometimes I get ideas for various things as well. So this one is What to Do When Your Brain Gets Stuck. She has another one here. This is a guide to overcoming anxiety, What to Do When You Worry Too Much. And then there's also one, What to Do When Mistakes Make You Quake, A Kid's Guide to Accepting Imperfection. So And she has a lot more. You can definitely look her up. This is a book that I needed as a child. I'm very much of a perfectionist. I do not like to mess up. But one of the reasons that I bought this is because, okay, yes, I needed this book as a child just to, you know that it's okay to make mistakes. But one of the reasons that I bought this is because, you know, now as an adult, I can care for the 8-year-old who needed this book. And so that's one of the reasons that I bought this. And I have these in my classroom, and you can have them in your home as well. There's some other ones. This one I bought. This one is called Someone I Love Died. I had a sibling set that I worked with. They had lost a brother a couple years ago. And when the anniversary of that, when that death anniversary came around, I did a few things with them just to celebrate the life of their brother. One of the things we did one year is I bought helium balloons, and they wrote notes to their brother on the balloons, and then we went outside, and we released the balloons and just watched them sail up into the sky, and it was such a good bonding moment with them. And then this one, this is a book called No Means No. Like I said, this is kind of just a wide variety of resources. I taught a first grade health class this spring, and this is a book about body safety. So it's a way of helping your children understand like what safe touch looks like. So when we talked about safety, we talked about body safety and how they can say no if they don't want to be hugged and so on. So my point, there's lots of books out there that can be used for topics that you're working on. Teach emotional regulation through co-regulation. We've discussed that already. Consider a professional trauma therapist. And the other thing that I would say, I don't think this is on your handout here, but the other thing that I want to say here with helping your children cope is be their biggest advocate. Be their biggest advocate, okay? So you know your child. You know what they need. You know what works and doesn't work. And I just want to hear you say, I want you to hear a teacher say this morning that we want to hear from you what your child needs and doesn't need. And I know sometimes the relationships between teachers and parents can be a bit rough, okay? And there might be trauma in your life just from the way the teacher didn't understand your child. So be your child's biggest advocate. Let your teacher know what they need and don't need, what works and doesn't work. And I know there's probably not all teachers that are like this, but I want to work with you as a team to help create a safe village for this child so that he or she can thrive. Okay, so we've talked about trauma, we've talked about children from hard places, we've talked about how to help children regulate, but what about you? You are the caregiver, you're the one in the trenches day after day after day. Are you taking care of yourself? So, I have a couple tips here for caregivers, and I've said caregivers because, again, could be parents, teachers. Just a couple things that I find are helpful for me if I'm dealing with a child from a hard place. Take a respite. Take a respite. We all know that we can't pour from empty cups. And when you're dealing with children from hard places, they can drain your cup pretty fast, right? Yeah. So for myself, I've learned that I can love my students better sometimes when I have a break from them. Okay, so for example, this is my schedule. Several times a week, I get a lunch period off. I get a 40-minute lunch break where I literally can eat lunch by myself. There's no one asking anything from me. I can sit in my classroom and just enjoy the quiet and eat my lunch. Those 40 minutes help me to love my little people better when they come back to me. And I think the same works for parents. I know, like I said, you're in the trenches. But find at least some time and space to care for yourself, to care for your heart. Care for your own woundedness as well. At the beginning, I gave you a bit, just a really quick snapshot of my story. And I know that I have been incredibly wounded in the past. One of the things that I'm really passionate about is that I work on and care for that woundedness so that I'm not just passing that on to my students, because we know how generational trauma works, right? It literally feels like it rolls down the hill from one generation to the next until someone stops, turns around, looks at the trauma, and says, "This stops with me. This does not continue." That's a really hard thing to do, and you can't do that alone, okay? But I'm concerned that I'm caring for my own woundedness so that I do not continue to hurt and abuse the children that I work with. Take time for what you love. I don't know what your hobbies are. If you enjoy gardening or woodworking, sports, music. I just discovered a new hobby this summer. I enjoy doing some simple crocheting, and last weekend I was with a group of friends, and I learned how to crochet a little animal octopus. Well, this is my newest thing, and I just think this is amazing. So I've been working at, you know, crocheting these little octopi, whatever, let's not split hairs over that. But on Thursday, when I went to help my sister for a day, I looked at what I had crocheted there, and I thought, oh, perfect, here are three little octopuses, and so I took them along, and I gifted my nephews and my niece each with a little octopus that I had made, and it was just really wonderful. I had so much fun making them, and they loved it. They were so happy with them, okay? So that's one thing that keeps me going, is making sure that I'm taking time for my hobbies, for creating. Be gracious with yourself. And sometimes this is really hard. You're in the hard place. And I know for us as perfectionists, and I don't think I'm the only perfectionist sitting here, it can be difficult when you reflect and you say, oh, I didn't do well with that interaction. The way I responded there wasn't kind, okay? Be gracious with yourself. You're not a bad mom because you yelled at your kids, all right? I think what is more important is being willing to tell your children when you messed up. Children are incredibly forgiving. They're incredibly forgiving. I had a student that I worked with. He had transferred to our school, and I knew that he had come out of a pretty significant negative school experience. He was just so shut down. And we were about 2 weeks into the school year, and I'm not even exactly sure what prompted the conversation, but I asked him a question about something he had said, and he opened up, and he just started telling me about his former school experience. And I looked at him, and I said, wow, Andrew, that must have been really hard. And he said, yeah, it was. And he described to me his, like how depressed he felt after being so shut down at school. He said, depression, when I left and I would go onto the bus, I would feel depressed. Depression lasted all evening. It lasts through the weekend. It lasts all school year. And I was just really grieved with that. But I said to him, you know, we at our school, we're going to try to really accommodate the way your brain works. We're not going to get it perfect, but we are going to try our best. And, you know, his response to me was not one of, well, yeah, you guys better get it right. He's like, it's okay. Almost like, you guys don't have to get it right all the time. And that was so incredible for me because as a perfectionist, it can be hard for me to be gracious when I feel like I've failed an interaction. Tell your children when you feel like you've messed up. They're so gracious with you. So as we wrap up here, as we think about the children that have come to us from hard places, we think about the children in our classrooms, our goal is that they blossom, that they grow, that they receive enough water to flourish, that they receive just enough of plant fertilizer to grow into a beautiful, colorful, wonderful version of themselves. And so I want to bless you in the journey. I know it's difficult. I know it's exhausting. But hopefully in the last hour, as we've been pondering, I want you to know that there's hope. Jesus is with you. He's called you to this work. And he will allow you to partner with him as you minister to your children. Thank you.